You know, if Deborah does dial. Ah, here we go. That's recording. I've seen, got it.
Yeah, it's recording now.
Yeah, the fun is it's now. I've got my laser pointer on, and the pop-up comes up on the screen, and I can't see my own slides. So.
Oh.
What fun. Okay, yeah, if, in case Deborah calls in and suddenly I'm happy to pause, or, you know, if she needs to sort of say something and go again, that's fine. So, thanks, Scott. All right, so hi, everyone, and welcome to this fourth module, and this is called the Value Proposition in ERC. And I guess I don't want to claim to know everything in this space. I guess I've been doing it a while, which is why I got asked to cover this. What I have noticed, I was commenting to Scott before we got started, was I don't remember us ever having a conversation on the value proposition as a topic area. And certainly it's not something that I've covered as such as part of the ILO discussions before. So this is a completely sort of pieced together in the last week or so set of slides, and it's been kind of interesting putting it together. So anyway, what it's worth, I'm going to try and tell you what I think of the value proposition in ERC. Excuse me. One thing I would say is that when I look back at my career, it's really been a career in value propositioning, and I hadn't really recognized that so much until relatively recently. It turns out when I look up the word value proposition on the web, it got identified as a term, at least in Wikipedia, somewhere in the 80s. And so there was the first part of my career where I was value propositioning without realizing exactly what that was. But of course, one always talks about value with a company and so on. So anyway, so although I've had a lot of history in industry, and then lately quite a bit of history now in two different ERCs, it's relatively a bit of a like a wake-up call that all this time I've been thinking about value propositions as part of what I do. This is a slide I had a last time or a couple of times ago when we talked, but I just wanted to comment again that there's been this thing about ILO role, and the main theme you're going to come out quite a bit in the presentation today, I decided, is this word multiple. But there are multiple dimensions in the role, and it's nice and easy to have this summary, which I think comes from the ERC web, which, you know, the role is to direct and implement strategies, develop the industry membership and innovation ecosystem program in the center. And then when you look at it, there's an awful lot of different elements to it, which is the multiple dimensions part. This is a definition off of Wikipedia, and essentially a value prop is a promise of value that relates then to benefits, costs, and the value that the, you know, the benefit cost equation brings together for some organization, whether it's a customer or whatever. And you know, somehow you've got to deliver that, you've got to communicate it, the receiving party's got to acknowledge it, give you feedback. You know, there's a whole like dimension, multiple dimensions, even in the first element of saying, well, what is a value prop? And again, back to themes, I think the next slide will cover this, or the next couple of slides will, which is back to multiple dimensions again. So I found this somewhere on the web, and it's just a copy of, as you can see, it's got this Latin stuff on again, but you know, I found this on the web, a nice way of saying, well, for a customer, there are various components of value proposition, from value to functional value, emotional value, economic value, maybe symbolic value. And the more you look, the more you uncover when you start searching around in value proposition. In the ERC web, the link is up there for this, there's a piece on in the best practices manual about the role of the ILO, and there was this study done in 2012 that covers a whole lot of stuff that, you know, in a survey with looking at benefits to industry, And there's a, you know, there's sort of 54% was in technology road mapping, and, you know, 23% on referrals and market assessment, 15%, a whole bunch then at 15. And then somewhere at the bottom of this is value proposition at 15. And then again, the words are copied out straight out of the ERC, but a clearly defined value proposition is a key to success in retaining members in the drive to self-sufficiency. How does the ERC choose to articulate its specific value proposition? It must show how the center can provide substantial benefits to stakeholders, industry, and so on. And the more I read this and the more I put my slides together, the more that this is what I came to realize, or at least in my own head realize, and maybe I'll try and persuade you of that. And I think this misses the point. And because to me, all of this stuff here is a value prop and not just one piece. And so to say this is just a small portion of, you know, the percent of respondents saying this was important, I think value prop lies behind all of these. And I also take exception to this. And of course, we're required in our reports to say, here's our value proposition. And it implies it's a single thing. And so we, you know, you write a sentence and then realize you have to write more. But again, my main point here is I'm going to tell you that I don't think there is such a thing as a single clearly defined value proposition. I think there are multiple value propositions across a range of different players. And it isn't just industry either, which I'll touch on in a minute. So this is C-STAR's brochure. On the right-hand side is a copy of it. And then this is a slide I often use when we're recruiting new members. But, you know, here's a sort of value prop. And we talk about member benefits for a cost. One of the breakouts in cost is this difference in IP, which in our case, gold members get access first option to intellectual property that comes out. Silver members don't get that first option. And then there's a reduction in cost for not getting that higher level of benefit. So here then is a string of value propositions that you might see written down here. And then written here is a whole bunch of things from IP to licensing, access to confidential information, beyond the advisory boards, research sponsoring, findings, networking, recruiting, promoting education. Again, multiple components to the benefits of being in a center like an ERC, and therefore, to me, then multiple value propositions, not just one. So my point is that I started it thinking about this in a sort of simple way, thinking, well, about value prop, we can all write that down. And so it seems simple enough, you know, here's us, ILO or SBI, sitting in the middle and, you know, holding up a newly found invention that comes from academia and industry interested in it. And it's a whole lot more complicated than just sitting in the middle between two parties and saying, well, A can talk to B. And that's again, part of what I'm going to try and expand on. So the other thing that occurred to me is that this word value proposition is embedded in this little diagram. And I'm sure those of you who've been playing around in the innovation space remember the layout of this. So this is the business model canvas. Here's the value proposition in the middle. And then customers on, in this case, customers from healthcare on the left, customer segment over on the right, revenue streams, cost structure, channels, relationships, and then, you know, how you work it out. And so what struck me when I stumbled over this one was reminded then of this book. I don't know how many of you have found this book somewhere, but it's a companion. I'm in the middle of teaching an entrepreneurship what we call the Innovation Academy in C-STAR. So these books are handy to me all the time. And this one's a really nice description of that one. Of course, that's based on the Business Model Canvas book and all that good stuff. And so then the value proposition design, which is this value proposition canvas, is a subcomponent then of the larger business model canvas, which is this thing. And what struck me when I was playing around with this was, okay, so one could look at an ERC and place it onto a business model canvas and think of it as, you know, here's us in the middle with some kind of product and benefit. And from that, you can start to populate it with, customer segments such as industry, large, medium, small, and they might get with and without access to IP. You're going to recruit them. You're going to want to retain them. I did this in a hurry, so don't sort of nitpick individual words here. But the principle is you can lay an ERC on top of this thing, and from that start to see the flow of, how the university's effort flows through resources and activities to provide a product. We as ILOs then are involved in recruiting and offering this product to industry and figuring out how to retain customers or industry members to be interested in the center. And so, if you want to think about your value prop, here's one way of doing it. What exactly is the product coming out? And as we saw, there's a long list of things. And that made me think that really you need to put a sort of much more complicated thing in the middle here. And that's what this is attempting to say, which is, there isn't just a single product and a single benefit, but a whole lot of things. And also, interestingly enough, some of the entities on the left here, which are our particularly faculty and the leadership in the ERC, they are also demanding of us in our role in the sense that we then provide a service to them over here. And so you could design a whole other business model canvas of how you relate and work with the center leadership and faculty, and then even students also. So it gets really complicated and multidimensional again, back to that multiple and dimensional. This is the C-star value chain. And I put this up because if I were to overlay on here the 31 members we've got, you'd find out we have quite a bunch up here, a few more here, a few more here, a few more here, not so many in this space. We do have a few stakeholders, which we think of as kind of partners in the center, which are predominantly national labs. And then up at the top here, we have a lot of supporting companies. And as it's turning out, the bulk of our membership sits up here in the companies that support these larger companies that are part of the value chain. So again, when I look just at the company's needs and interests in the center, they are not uniform. And when we do surveys, which I'll touch on another slide later, but when we do surveys, we also get this feedback. You can't put all industry in one box and say, this is the value proposition to our members, because the members vary a lot in what they're looking for. Here's the ecosystem. It starts to add the multidimensionality part to the center, but here's our role, the industry and partnering thing. There's a whole lot of networking and might be sponsored projects, advice and guidance, real world applications, and partnering with academia. There's iCore involved and so on. So the more you add, the more complicated the role gets. And here's a bunch of national labs in our center. Here's a bunch of different centers at different universities that we're working with. I now teach this class in Innovation Academy. These are all value propositions, all of them. So that's the synthesis then of what I've been trying to say for 20 minutes or so, which is there isn't such a thing as a single value proposition. There are multiple. And our role interacts with industry members, the center directors, whatever component of innovation is going on in the center, however you work as in your role with the leadership team. I know it varies by center as well. The students and SLC and what they want out of us as ILOs. It's not always just contact with industry, but sometimes everything from mentorship out to internships, jobs, and so on. Faculty varies quite a bit. The institutions see different things from us. And then finally, NSF, and they have their own demands of what we provide. So what does everyone need? different things, multiple pieces, and it's not easy to write a single value prop. The other thing that occurs to me, having lived through 9 years of one ERC and now 4 years of a second one, is that the needs in every ERC are different, and they also change over time. And so it's possible to sort of, I've just done this like arbitrarily, but you know, it's possible to say, well, you know, sometimes these are the primary drivers all the time, directors and industry members. There's always an innovation piece. The students, faculty, institutions in NSF are often a little smaller, but nevertheless, always a value prop to even them. And then I did want to sort of highlight this one. IP as a value proposition is something that NSF push all the time, and it's way overemphasized for what it is. It's often not that highly valued by industry. They are very nitpicky over making sure the language in the industry agreement allows them to capture something of value, but oftentimes they aren't taking that value, and oftentimes there isn't that much going on actually in the IP space. There's often interest in it, but not that translates into actual taking of IP. It's not always true. There can always be something that's really valuable and kind of goes off into orbit. So through that, I started thinking, well, maybe you could compile a kind of listing like this of these various bubbles. And from that, we could start to say, you know, what does your ERC want? And, you know, at its simplest, industry wants to see research, but every one of these columns here also wants to see something being delivered from the ILO, whether it be growth in membership or technology transfer or connection between students and industry, insight into what industry's thinking, so that can be fed back to leadership and the directors in the center. And so it goes on. What I wondered about, if you wanted to do, we could come back to this slide, but I think perhaps in the interest of time, I'll push forwards into the next slide, which is my attempt to just populate that. And, you know, with this, just like one word for each one. And then here become the various value propositions for industry, which is something to do with research, something to do with innovation and you know, new technologies, something about recruiting, internship, of course, identifying know-how. There can be licensing of IP. There's often a kind of insights thing. There's definitely an advising role. There's sponsoring of work that can rise to the surface really quickly. Partnering and then access to faculty. And then you go across these others. I don't think I'm going to read them all, but there are some common pieces. NSF want to see industry in the center. They want to see some innovation going on. They demand that we have a SWOT, which is provided by industry. They want to understand the value chain. They want to see nice reports from us. And they'd love to see us licensing IP. It's a nice quantifiable metric for them.
Peter, may I ask a question?
Yeah.
Thank you. I like this kind of as a template at the, but I'm curious about instantiating, especially the industry column. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these are kind of like just good as they stand as reminders, you know, what the NSF is looking for, what we have to deliver on. The industry one, this strikes me as, okay, this is actually a great top level list, but I'm curious about thoughts from you or from others, how much effort and what kind of process to put into explicitly breaking this out, you know, having a conversation perhaps at annual meeting or other meet, you know, is this worth investing meaningful time into with the industry partner, with faculty, saying, so, you know, what have we got under each of these that really speaks to you? You would say, yeah, that's a value proposition under research, innovation, these, you know, various categories that aren't, you know, it's unique to each center.
Yeah. So first of all, I absolutely agree. And once I'd done this, I started thinking, well, I'll do a slide for each one of these. And then I started running out of time and didn't, and it would have taken quite some time to add it all. So what I'm going to suggest, I've only got two slides left. So I'm going to run to the end and then I'll come back to this slide because I think there's some meat to talk about here. Does that sound okay with you?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I agree with what you're saying. There's essentially there's a slide on or a suite of slides on every one of those these topics off to the left here. So we'll come back to that. So this partially addresses what you're asking. The diagram, don't worry about it. I just found that on the web and it was nice and colorful, so I threw it in here. But the point here is what's written to the left. Your members want different things, and it's not the same across all ERCs, and it's not the same across all your different members. Okay. And the way to start finding that out is to do surveys. And you can do that offline after a meeting with Qualtrics or some kind of survey thing. And that will help you get an insight on what it is that's rising to the top as the most valuable things. And I am certain when you do that, you're going to find multiple answers. There'll be some coalition around innovation, insight, students is one of the ones that always rises to the top, actually. Access to students in the context of, well, I might want to hire them, nearly always comes out top. In the two ERCs I've seen, and now probably 5 or 6 or 7 different surveys we've done in different ERCs. So it's amazing how often that one comes up. It was a bit of a surprise to me when I first found that one out. I knew it was important, but it's to find it so high up is interesting. Okay, so I would encourage you to run surveys and try and find out from them, and do it in a nice colored chart like this. You can then put it up and show NSF you ran a survey, and then this is how you're responding to that survey. They love seeing things like this. Okay, so I'm all pretty much finished here, but comment is, the closing advice is focus on recruiting, retaining, and keeping them remaining involved in the center. And to do that is to run some surveys. And that's the end of my slides. So with that, I'll do what I promised to do, which is go back to that one. And we could talk about that if you want, or take other questions. So that's my slides. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot, much, Peter. And there's been some chat around Lindsay's survey to get exactly at these questions. In my experience, I've not every industry member that I've ever recruited had a different suite of reasons. Rarely is it one thing, right? It's a suite of things. But the weight of each of those items is different for all our industry members. There isn't a common. This is what this kind of company wants. And it's so dependent on the leadership and the state of the company and the size and all these factors, right?
It's not just the company. It might, because you're not in touch. We talk about we have some multinationals, I'm sure you all do. They've got 50,000, 100,000 employees and you're talking to two people.
Right. Yes. Yep. Exactly right. It's multifaceted for sure. Yeah. And, I don't know if you want to come back to Stephen's question now, because you're right, there's a lot of meat to that. And Lindsay responded in chat, like I was saying, with a survey that she puts out to really substantiate what these interests are. And I don't know, Lindsay, if you want to share anything about that.
Yeah, we just launched it. I wanted to streamline our member onboarding process. And so as part of that, I worked... This is where U of M has a Qualtrics agreement, right? So we can create all kinds of Qualtrics things. You could use something like Typeform or Google Forms too, but so I managed to get a graduate student from the Carlson School of Management to I basically gave him the questions and the logic and then he coded it all. And once it was coded in, it's actually pretty straightforward to like make changes. You know, the challenge with any survey for your industry is you want to keep it under 5 minutes or less. Like you want them to be able to blitz through it pretty easily because they don't want to spend time on it, but still get useful information in the end. And so we, to your point, Peter, for right now, and you know, 5 years from now, maybe it'll be different. I rolled things up into sort of 4 key values and then sort of grouped some of these things into underneath them. And then I sort of asked them at the top level of those 4, which are the sort of order of importance. And then within those, what are the things that are really speaking to them? And I will say this, the onboarding survey actually has 2 pieces. And the first piece is actually, how do you want to be engaged? And like, it gives you a list of activities you can be engaged in. But then, and then this is the second part, is really around specifically like, what made you decide to join? Right. And I'm more explicitly tying it to the language I use to recruit. And my plan, ask me in a year, is annually is to take that value proposition again as part of an annual. We'll do an annual survey to be like, did you participate in any of the following? Did you do any of the following? Right. But then again, this kind of value prop testing will show up again. Worded slightly differently, but basically, you know, again, kind of keen on like, what, if you're renewing, why are you renewing? And trying, and to your point, like my, based upon the data I've already seen from our existing set of members, like it, pretty much all of them apply, right? It depends, depending on your member, right? A different set are more or less important. So, you know, I have mixed feelings. On one hand, I'm like, well, I have this, to your point, Peter, this really nice set of data. I can like point to it at NSF. And on the other hand, I'm like, I came to the same, you know, I'm like, well, basically I'm right. But that doesn't necessarily tell me that like, I should put more energy into X versus Y. It just tells me X, Y, and Z are all important. So I don't know.
You're reminding me of the, you know, that sort of, it's not a magician's thing, but you know, they have those long sticks and they put a plate on the top and start spinning it. And then they see how many plates they can get. You've seen these things. So I often think that's like an ILO's role, actually, is, you know, these names here are written on every plate and you've really got to keep them all spinning.
You know, what I'll add to that is, you're right, Peter, there's a lot of spinning, and you're right, Lindsay, keeping the data fresh is important. I've found at least that the value propositioning work I do for CNT and recruiting is different than what I do for retention. That typically when I recruit a member for the center, the reason I'm successful in recruiting them is X or X, Y, and Z. And then once they get into the center and they see the students firsthand, or when they see this or that, or when they really dive into the IP, or when whatever the thing is, what keeps them is ABC instead of XYZ. And so I haven't done the surveys, and I'm really interested to see what you've done. That's brilliant to engage someone else to do the coding. That's fantastic. I'm curious how this works out for you, because I haven't done that, not because I don't think it's a good idea, but it's because I've been forced to sort of just pound the pavement and keep my ear to the ground and just talk, because I don't know if I could capture that in a 5-minute survey, because you're right, surveys longer than that don't work for them. But it changes. It's so fluid, and so being able to assess those changes is important from my perspective. But I'll also add, for the recruiting piece, identifying the value proposition, because to Peter's slide with the customers, you know, presentation went great up until the point the customer didn't buy the product. For me, the most successful recruiting visits I've had has been when I've been able to, you know, do obviously a lot of research on the company, figure out what their annual reports and other things say about what they're interested in. But importantly, if I'm able to connect with someone who used to be in that company that's now somewhere else, maybe they're part of our industry membership in a different company. Sometimes I get references or links or introductions to companies from industry members that have come from that company. And they'll often give you the scuttlebutt about, you know, hey, here's a key point for them, or here's what's really going to ring their bell. And being able to take that in with me in crafting a pitch that includes the value proposition for them has been really helpful for me.
Peter, this is Nasser. Nice presentation. I have one small comment and then a couple of questions. With respect to the overemphasis on IP, primarily from the NSF, completely, fully agree, and I've lived through that for the last 7 years. So,
yeah,
IP really has a very small, actually, I don't want to say small value, but it's not as important as people would like to believe, and it certainly cannot be relied on for sustainability after year 10 funding. So I fully agree. My two questions are, what do you mean by support? I think I understand, but can you please elaborate on what you mean by support in the top row? And go ahead, and I'll follow up with the second question.
Yeah, sure. And hi, Nasser, nice to see you. So what I'm getting at there is that faculty, students, leadership are all looking for an understanding of what it is that they're supposed to do for an ERC that can help them feel valued, if you will, in the center. And so I think there's a supporting role that we play, which is a kind of translational aspect of working with both, faculty, students, and leadership, and trying to figure out what they are looking for out of us also as a value proposition. So I just broadly call that support. Sometimes with the leadership team, in my experience, it's been what I call psychological support, trying to help them sort of position where the center's going, and over the years, as you evolve the center to wherever it's going to finish up, there's a need to make sure that's aligned with what industry it feel good about, and then there's a need to be able to convey that adequately to NSF so that they don't think you've done something crazy. So there's a whole melee of things in what I've written there as support. So there's a supporting role for an ILO with all of the components in the ERC outside of the industry piece.
Okay. And with respect to your bottom question there, what do your members want? You posed that question. Let me just narrow it down and ask you, in the industry column, if you were looking only at research, recruitment, and let's say partnering, I assume partnering on research or collaboration is what that means.
Yeah.
So those three things, research, recruitment, and partnering. And I know you've been in at least two ERCs that I'm aware of. Do you see more focus on one of those three things, depending on the company sector or the segment that they're in? So for example, in civil, we have a lot of consultants that are members of our center, but we also have several owners. So when I say owners, I mean like a mining company, an oil company, and the consultants are consultants. Do you see that different groups amongst your IAB are a little bit different in their specific interest, with those three things that I highlighted?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely different. And it just brings up too many thoughts to answer in a specific way here. But, smaller companies are really... I think for smaller companies, they're often looking for a place where they're at the table and able to meet with some of the large companies. So in some ways, it's access to other companies that they're getting out of joining the center. And what are not just other companies, but actually leaders in a field that they happen to be a sort of small entity in. And so a relationship gets built there honestly, it's pretty hard for them to foster without being in an ERC like this or them meeting them at a conference or something. So I think for small companies, it can be quite a lot different from what a large company is looking for. That's one thing. And also small companies might be looking for ways to bolster the research in specific ways where they could sponsor something, even though they're small, they might sponsor some research that internally, it'd be pretty hard for them to get done. Large companies might see that more in the eyes of like, oh, okay, I got some insight over that. I'm going to go to this department in this large company and actually access that now. And so in our center, we do a lot of computational catalysis, and That's been a bit of an interesting game, that, because it's opening up all sorts of eyes about how to tackle some of these chemical engineering aspects with computers instead of, and small companies are not very connected to this. Large companies have got it going, but they're different and not quite so cutting edge as our center is. So there's, again, value proposition sitting right there that's kind of at first intangible.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. I do want to touch on IP, actually. You just reminded me again. You all know the Gatorade story. Everyone talks about the Gatorade one, but there's a few ERCs that have gone into orbit because of occasional bits of like amazing IP. And one of them is the Georgia Tech one on hard drives and, you know, cramming more information into the same size piece of a chip. There's the center, whatever it was, the optic nerve center that was looking at trying to restore eyesight. And they had some really cool IP that finished up, you know. So there's, you know, it's the classic problem that your university IP office faces when they're receiving IP, which is that most of the IP is never going to make them any money at all. But, you know, it just takes one or two and boom, you've got it outweighs all the losses from the one or two. So if an ERC can hit one, it can be really powerful. So I'm kind of jaded over IP because I do think NSF overemphasize it. They kind of count it and then, you know, like how many companies are you getting that's licensing that? And then you get beaten up for as soon as you say, well, nobody's taking any of it. And really, that's actually the norm.
You're not wrong, Peter. It's like playing the lottery.
Yeah.
But each lottery ticket is not likely going to produce what you hope it is. And I think especially for centers that are very involved in very nascent technology, it takes a while to build a portfolio that is applicable at where industry wants to play. You know, they don't want to mess around with stuff that isn't going to actually be commercializable. And for an early center that's in an early technology space, a lot of the inventions and discoveries, they're still basic science in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'm glad you said the word portfolio, because that's another thing. So C-Star we've not got a lot of patents, but it's in the average range, I'd say. And we had zero licensing to report until this year. And we've had one company take a license to nine. So it's about 40% of our, no, it's not nine, sorry, it's 13 filings, intellectual property filings, and it represents about 40% of our IP gone to one company. I don't know if it's useful, but they've taken a whole portfolio attitude to it.
That's really interesting, yeah.
We had one company license about half of our IP, and the pat in the back we received was, what about the other ones?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, there's always magic in IP if it can work. So.
Hey, Peter, this is Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Fantastic presentation. And maybe to me, maybe a little depressing laying this out, I see right now, of all the things we actually do.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, we actually all do that. But I do have one question for you, probably because of all your experience. I could see the value propositions change over the life of the ERC as you're coming out with more technologies, as you're, you know, more impacts are coming out along those lines. And how does that shift your focus? Do all of a sudden more faculty get involved, the more support it comes in? You know, what does that early, middle, and later years kind of look like? You know, because obviously things here are going to change and your priorities are going to change as the life of the ERC goes.
Yeah, I think there isn't a straight answer to that, but I think in general terms, you want to see more stuff rising to the surface that that leads either to insights or licensing or sponsoring, such that you can start going home thinking, well, actually something happened in the last year in some broad way that takes you towards a sort of long range value proposition of the center. Are you having an impact in the space you're in? And I think that's the sort of growing up aspect that that eventually leads to sustainability, as NSF would like to call it. And it's very difficult to travel through all that. And I think it changes it so there's some early stuff to deal with and just get it ticked off. Interns, you know, make sure you're properly managing how the IP is reported to industry, make sure they're getting access to faculty as well as students, make sure that you're harvesting their advice and changing based on that advice so that you can tell NSF, listen, this is the advice we're getting. You might want us to go here, but this is what our industry members are saying. You know, they're very valuable, like steering rod, as it were, to NSF is your industry members. So I don't think I answered that very well, but more impactful stuff across the board as you get in the later years.
Yeah. And then a follow-up question is, as the mill years start going by and you see more impact, are you intentionally seeking that out with your faculty and directors and leadership, or how is that communicated to you? Do you attend their weekly, biweekly meetings? You know, how do you make sure that something's got something cool and neat and yet you didn't hear about it? You know, how do you make sure things don't slip through the cracks, as they say?
Yeah. So I don't attend any of the thrust level, project level meetings because I don't have time. But I am part of the leadership team of the center, and I attend all of those. There's a very interesting role that you can build for yourself in helping to steer the center, which is back to the support thing that I think we touched on earlier. You know, there's steering the center to a place that has value and potential in the sense of being sustainable it takes a village to put that together. I know it's a cliche, but it takes a whole lot of good, solid thinking over a long, prolonged period of time.
You know, Chris, at C&T at least, I wish I could tell you that every time a faculty or student at the center submitted a disclosure or started the patent process, so that they would reach out to me and say, hey, Sky just did that, but they don't. They don't. I almost never find out. You know, even when I take several faculty, I go to lunch with them on a regular basis. And even then, you know, I'll find out like the next day after we had lunch that they've done this thing. Like, why did that not come up during the lunch? But what has helped me tremendously is I have regular meetings and lunches, and we have a Thai spot where I invite the tech transfer office folks to, and we eat regularly, and they've given me access to their database where I can search for specific faculty. You know, students change so much, it's hard to keep up with them, but the faculty are usually on them as well. And so searching that on a regular cadence is really my primary source of information for what the center's faculty are doing around IP. Because yeah, it just doesn't, for whatever reason, they just don't, they don't think to, it's not that they don't like to brag, because they like to brag.
But
for whatever reason, it just doesn't come up.
So we don't track ours like that. Be interested to know if any of you. So what we do is we give the IP officers at each of the universities, we give them the grant number that's the ERC grant that we've got, the unique, whatever it is, nine numbers code. And we tell them, you know, as soon as you're ready, because they have to do their due diligence first, but as soon as you're ready to say this is something we're going to move forward with, that's when you send me an email. And I don't do any of this searching for whether they're doing it right or not. I just, because that unique identifier they have to use when the IP is filed.
And that's the process you describe is how we get, how I get the data for the IP report. You know, we do an annual IP report like everyone else does and send out to the industry members. But for, you know, if I'm going to be talking with a company, you know, an ultrasound company, for example, and before I go, I want to know what IP is in process, and it's usually not around when we're doing the IP.
I see. So you mean several, I see.
Yeah. So just taking a look at what the center has in process around that.
Well, and also maybe what faculty, because there might be a portfolio of things not solely funded by the EOS. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's an interesting angle. Okay.
This is John from CellMet. A couple things on IP. One is what Tom Dudley started, which I continue, is at the end of every quarter, we send an email to all of the licensing or tech transfer offices at the member universities and give them a list of the faculty that have been involved in CellMet and ask if they've disclosed anything this quarter. And they are all pretty good about reporting. Sometimes it takes a few nudges. So we get not, you know, the stuff in process, but the stuff that's actually been disclosed and filed upon from every member institution, so we can compile it and send it out to the IPAB, you know, members. And then the other thing I think about IP, and back to the earlier conversation, you know, it's rare that you have this home run patent that gets licensed. But when I was in industry, you know, I would often get asked to pay for these types of things by folks in our research organization. And I would sort of say, what are the benefits? And, you know, one of the most tangible benefits to use with higher ups that controlled the pocketbook was, well, we're interested in this research. We'll likely use the university to do it. And the way their sponsored research agreements are, we don't have IP rights. And this gives us a preferred option, you know, to IP. And even if it's not real, it builds a value proposition. You know, to open up the pocketbook, if you will. So,
very true. Yeah. That's where I think to your point, John, that's the process of collecting the information from the tech transfer offices for the annual report. Yeah, very similar to what we do here. And it sometimes does take nudges, but I make it a point whenever I go to our partner institutions, which with COVID has not been in a while, but usually I would make sure a couple times a year or at least once a year, I went to the institution. And when I did, I always made it a point not just to meet with faculty and the deputy directors, but also with the tech transfer offices. And I use this phrase a lot, buy them lunch. I spend a lot of money on lunches, but it's so worth it because, you know, having that relationship with them so that when you email them 6 months later saying, hey, remember, as a reminder, here's a list of faculty. Can you pull and send me the data for what they've got completed? They'll do it because they know me and we, you know, keep those ties open. So as with anything else, it's all about relationship. And those certainly are folks to keep close.
Yeah, good point. Good. It is good to meet them, definitely. Yeah,
I found it interesting that even if you meet with faculty and you have lunch with them, and then you find out the next day about their cool IP they just submitted or a publication, you go, why?
Yep. And it's funny. And the faculty are, they're geniuses so many times. And, but yeah, it's funny. It's funny. Yeah. Lindsay's got a question.
It's a little bit related to that. I just went through the process of getting our IP management process finalized and met with all the TTOs and all the officers. So like, I think the nice thing is, I think we all understand to your point, that it takes a village to get these faculty to do this the way they're supposed to. And so we all kind of like, well, I talked a lot about it. I was like, well, this is what I'm doing on my end to make sure they're aware of the IP policy and they're finding it. But I need your help to, like, I don't care what they come in with, just flat out, whether that, if the ATV bio number is on there, great. If not, you need to ask. And so I think hopefully that'll head it off. But my question was a little bit more thinking it through around, you know, this to your point, Peter, like I've like this has been a fair amount of work and then like staying on top of it and then, you know, reminding the faculty versus what benefit we're going to get from it. And so with that in mind, I've really been thinking about this of like, how do I streamline and for lack of a better way, automate it so that on my end, it does not take a lot of work and effort to manage. And I think, like I said, I do know this, like in theory, right? All the faculty have read our IP policy. In theory. And
oh,
so,
Lindsay. Oh.
Yeah, I know, right? I know. And so, yeah, I'm just, if anybody, you know, my best, I'm just trying to figure out how to, again, like remind them to think, you know, like even if they've read it, I don't think they've thought through the implications. No. And then, you know, like I'm not so naive to think that I don't have to like continually remind them.
Well, there's a support role right there. And really an expectation, actually. I think a lot of faculty see that as it isn't my job. I really don't care. Somebody else is looking after it. It's Lindsay's job.
Yeah, I know. But like, yeah. So anyhow, perspective advice, but I
had the interesting challenge.
That's been my thought on it is like, how do I automate this as much as possible so that it's like, and I like this like quarterly, I'm just going to check in because in theory, the TTOs are supposed to tell me, but I like this idea. I'll just put it on my calendar and. Hey guys.
I think for your first year as a center, that is never the wrong answer. I mean, automation is great and simplifying your time is absolutely valuable. But as you're getting to know all the folks there and the faculty, that the more face time you can spend with them, even if it's on a Zoom, the more impactful future emails and future automation is going to be for you, I think. Right. You know, I had my first year at the CNT, I had to dispel my faculty of the notion that they all were all under this assumption that the only good reason to submit an invention disclosure was if you wanted to create a startup. Because we'd had several faculty who did just that, who had some great IP and did a startup and then nothing wrong with that. It's fantastic. But there was this general around the College of Engineering, the sense that the Tech Transfer Office only wanted startups and didn't really want to waste its time on IP that wasn't going to create a startup with them at the helm. And that was, I spent a good year plus meeting with faculty and every once in a while, I'll still come up again, but dispelling them of that notion. And so it's FaceTime. I wouldn't have heard that just through emails or anything else. So spending time with these folks and getting to understand what their concerns are, what keeps them up at night and what solutions the center can bring for them as faculty is definitely time well spent. We're coming up towards the end of our time. Peter, how about maybe time for one more question or any closing thoughts from you? Does anyone have one last question for Peter? Peter, maybe a final statement?
Nope, don't have anything brilliant to say.
You've said it all, Peter.
Good luck and have at it, right?
Yeah. So,
I tell you, there you go. I say this all the time. No matter where you are in an ERC, you're always in the foothills of the mountain. You think you're getting up there and you're not. There's just another one beyond the way you're at.
There's always another peak over the horizon.
You're always in the foothills, yeah.
All right. Wise sage advice, Peter. Guys, everyone, thank you for being on the call today. Peter, if you'll send me your slides, I'll make sure they're posted onto the ILO portion of the NSF website, and those and the recording will be up there later on this week for anyone who would like to listen in. So with that, guys, thanks again for joining. Peter, thank you so much. Big wave to Peter for the great presentation, great information. Thanks again for doing it.
Yep. Take care, everyone. Cheers.
See you guys next time.